Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network's brand new Caribbean Studies channel. I'm Alejandra Bronfman, and today I'll be speaking with Ada Ferrer, author of Freedom's Mirror, Cuba and Haiti in the Age of Revolution, just out with Cambridge University Press. When the Haitian Revolution destroyed slavery in Haiti, it spurred the intensification of slavery in Cuba, just a short distance across the water. Freedom's Mirror tacks back and forth between Cuba and Haiti and renders this paradox in concrete and vivid terms. As people, information, ships, and objects traveled between these two places, they inhabited a Caribbean space in which slavery, anti-slavery, imperialism, and sovereignty were in constant and intimate tension. Ada Ferrer's book immerses readers in this moment with stories of unlikely alliances, fear, greed, and idealism. It is beautifully written and a really impressive example of history that shifts among sweeping geopolitical processes and on-the-ground stories of individuals and their trajectories. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Ada, welcome, and thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can we start out with you talking about your trajectory as a historian and how you came to this specific project?
Sure. Well, sometimes I feel like I came to history a little bit late. I started out as an English major and then decided I wanted to keep going to school and did a master's in history. I knew always, once I had started history in graduate school, that I wanted to work on Cuba, in part for personal reasons, having been born there and not ever having traveled there at that point. So I started working on Cuban history and went to the University of Michigan to work with Rebecca Scott, who had a big influence on me, worked there with people like Krishmit Nawara, who passed away just this week, very sad. And I got interested in questions of slavery and emancipation. I did my first book, as you know, on the Cuban Wars of Independence and the participation of former slaves. And while I was working on that project, I kept coming up against the specter of Haiti, the comparisons that the Spanish state and opponents of independence made between any attempt at Cuban independence in which people of color participated and a particular version of the Haitian Revolution. So I became interested in the question of what people in Cuba actually knew about the Haitian Revolution and how information circulated and what meaning it had in Cuba. So that's kind of how I started on the project.
Thanks. You know, it's really interesting that at the heart of your book is the tension between the destruction of slavery in Haiti and the emergence of a very powerful slave society in Cuba. And it's been an accepted trope in Caribbean historiography for such a long time, right? But it's this kind of unexamined trope. We always say that together in lectures, but nobody has really taken the time to sort of uncover and the processes by which that happened and all of those connections. So I'm wondering how did you come to realize that those two stories needed to be told together?
Yeah, well, again, that was also a kind of gradual process. When I started the project and I did my first research trip for Freedom's Mirror in fall of 1998, I believe, so a long time ago. And I really was just focused then on the question of information and circulation of news of Haiti, more along the lines of kind of a Julia Scott common wind analysis. And the more I began to work on it, I realized that, of course, this news is circulating at the moment that Cuban slavery is being transformed, right? The number of captives arriving are growing, the number of mills being established. So there was this coincidence in time that that was clearly important. And then I thought, well, that has to affect then the way the circulation of information happens and the meanings that people attach to it. So I didn't foresee that question initially being so important, but it gradually seemed to me to be, you know, of utmost importance, right? That if people are hearing about Haiti at the same moment that the landscape of slavery is being transformed in the country, that has to shape the way they think about a slave revolution, and the slave revolution then has to shape the way they think about slavery. So that became the dynamic at the center of the book.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I want to talk about this question of information and media in just a minute. But first, I want to just ask you a couple of questions about the broader framing. And one is actually, why do you think that this story hasn't been told? Because once you read your book, it makes so much sense to tell them together. It's as if you can't tell them without one another. But nobody has really done this before. And do you have a sense of why that's the case?
Yeah, well, you know, I think people have done, you know, bits and pieces of it. So I think a Cuban historian like José Luciano Franco, for him, the Haitian Revolution is critical. I think for, you know, Matt Childs working on Aponte, he obviously knew about the importance of the Haitian Revolution. But in some sense, the central question for each of them and for other people who worked around these kinds of topics, the central question has been another one, and I just made the question specifically the length, and maybe the moment made that more possible, the fact that national history has given way to more kind of transnational framings. Maybe that made it more possible in this moment, perhaps. And also, I think, you know, I remember when I was at Michigan, Robin Kelly was there as a professor, and then he became my colleague here at NYU, and he always used to talk about, you know, follow the people, follow the money. And I think in some sense, again, even though I knew the project was going to be Cuba and Haiti, the extent to which it would be about the connection also wasn't clear at the end. I mean, this could have been a purely Cuban book. I think it's more Cuban than Haitian as it is, but it could have been a purely Cuban book just on the circulation of an idea of Haiti or ideas of Haiti in Cuba. But then once I got in the archive and just started following the sources out, I had to go out. And I allowed myself to go out in part because that kind of framing has become so much more important in recent years. So I think in a sense, like, some people have done things around it, but then to make the connection itself central, no one had done. And I think, again, partly it's the moment that makes it possible. And
This notion of following the people and the money, which is really clearly very important to you in the book, and which you do really wonderfully, I'm wondering how that creates new problems for you, right? Because it makes it much more difficult, I think, to shape a kind of narrative that has the kind of flow that it actually does. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how the kinds of decisions that you made to shape that narrative, and how you manage to follow people back and forth and tell one big overarching story, which is really impressive.
Yeah. You know, it's such a process researching and writing a book, right? So it's not like one makes a decision to do that. Initially, it kind of evolves organically, I think. And then in terms of following specific people, I'll speak from one of the chapters, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. If you take, you know, chapter 3, which is on the period of the war between France and Spain on the border between Santo Domingo and Saint-Domingue, right? I never would have foreseen that one of the chapters would unfold primarily in Santo Domingo. I hadn't thought that at the outset. But as I was in the archive looking for when people in Cuba were talking about the revolution, one of the key moments was that, right? In 1793, all these Cuban soldiers went to Santo Domingo to fight with black rebels against the French Republic. So I followed these Cubans to Santo Domingo and to the border, right? And again, so that became a really important episode, because then I said, okay, I have to find out more about these people, right? And you start researching these individuals who went, and you realize, well, some of them are slave owners, some of them are sugar plantation owners, and they're in Saint Domingue, and they're allied with these former slave rebels. And then I followed them back to Cuba, and so so you have the question, you think, can I take this somewhere? And you kind of get a little obsessed with it, and you look for them everywhere you go, and you go to places just to look for them, right? And so, you go to Segovia to see if you could find their military file, and you go to a little town in the middle of nowhere near Ciudad Real to see if you could find information, right? So you kind of, and sometimes the archive cooperates and sometimes it doesn't. And then also when you've worked on a project for this long, sometimes you don't know that you have something that you have, right? So you're doing something towards the end and you're telling a story and you think, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. And you look at all your notes and you find something incredibly important about that person that you didn't even know you had, that you found 10 years earlier, right? Right. So that's what I'm saying. It wasn't always a conscious intention. It's just kind of, I think it happened as a result of, well, doing the archival research for so long in different places, and then looking for people and looking for stories and trying to link them up. I don't know if that's a very clear answer. It's just my process, I guess.
It is, actually. And one of the things that I noticed also is that you follow people, but you also follow information. And there's this notion of the importance of, I guess this is where the project started, right? And
yeah,
the importance of media and information. And the way, also, I really like the way you kind of broadened media to include ships and also to include people, right, who are carriers of information. So that...
Right.
That's really... Yeah. It makes a really important point, I think. But I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this chapter three, because I found that just so confounding in some ways, right? This description of the alliances between the black auxiliaries and the representatives of the Spanish, many of whom are slaveholders who are fighting supposedly for the same side, but then also some of the black auxiliaries are selling people. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that whole scene and how it worked. And my question really is, do you think this was as confusing on the ground for the people who were in it as it seemed to me? I don't know if it was confusing to you at first, but it was just so mind blowing, all of the things that were going on there.
Yeah. So, I love that chapter. And again, it's one that I hadn't foreseen at the beginning, in part because I didn't know about this, right? We all know that during the Haitian Revolution, the Spanish allied with the Haitian rebels, with the black rebels from the revolution. Mm-hmm. So that's a critical chapter in the story of the Haitian Revolution. And we know from other sources that some of the troops had come from Cuba. Sherry Johnson mentions that briefly, for instance. But I just had no idea about the extent of the contact until I started working with these sources from Simancas. And then you hear about, the dinners, you hear about the dances, you hear that the Marqués de Casacalvo, right, a sugar plantation owner, became godfather to Jean-François, right? So these are links that are clearly vital and important. And it just helps us think about the meaning of Haiti for Cuba in a completely different way. We're so used to thinking that, well, in Cuba, the elite was so scared of the Haitian Revolution that they could never imagine independence, right? And that's a common trope. I used it in my first book. We all use it, right? Mm-hmm. But then you think, okay, actually, there's a small part of that elite that was actually in the Haitian Revolution, and they knew Toussaint, and they negotiated with Jean-François, and they had this very important contact with them. This wasn't actually fear. It was much more pragmatic than that, right? They always thought mm-hmm. that they could control it. And so anyway, so it provides like a new lens into that old question about fear. But then also, I mean, as you say, you don't know, the Cubans were completely confused. Here they are, and they're allied with these rebels who they've been hearing about as murderers and rapists, and these are their allies. These are their people they're working with. So, you know, and the letters from Matias Armona, who was the first commander, he's completely confused, right? And then I think for the Black rebels, the same was true, right? That the Spanish were promising them all kinds of things, but then they were inviting back white planters, and the white planters were kind of intimating that they would re-enslave people, right? So I think it's a really uncertain, tense, loaded encounter on all sides. And I was going to say something else about that, and it just slipped my mind. But yes, I do think, the other thing is that, so I thought that in that chapter, you get the sense of Cuba going to the Haitian Revolution, right? So there, if you think about the memory and the knowledge of Haiti and Cuba, it's not just this like third hand rumor. These people were actually there and witnessed it and knew some of the people and were participants in it in some sense, right? So it clearly shifts what we know about Cuba's understanding of the Haitian, Cuban understandings of the Haitian Revolution. But I think it also maybe points to the ways in which the fact that Cuba was so close and the fact that Cuba was a growing slave system also impacted the Haitian Revolution itself, right? That Toussaint is making decisions about who to ally with in part by observing the behavior and the actions of these Cuban men who are his allies and commanders and who are also slave owners and purchasing people and doing all kinds of things like that, right? So that also affects the history of the Haitian Revolution itself.
Yeah, the way that you really get at the concrete way in which those two are not just, like you say, not just hearing about it or not just kind of random, vague rumors, but actually interacting with people and actually shaping each other's processes is really fascinating. And I loved, actually, in that chapter, the bit about the traffic of objects, right? So they're this kind of sugar equipment that gets sold because it's no longer useful, and people are just picking up stuff as if it were on eBay or something.
Yes.
That stuff
it's
is...
Cubans involved in illicit business. It's a long, long history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Humans, yes.
Trading back and forth. But then that all sort of comes to an end, right? When Toussaint switches loyalty. And one of the stories, again, here is this, the very complicated, as I guess... the war within a war, as Trio would describe it, right? There's all of this stuff going back and forth, and these switching loyalties, and it's astonishing.
Yes, but you like that one,
yeah. But then at the same time, and you move on to the effect actually of knowledge about Toussaint in Cuba, and the very negative ideas about him that eventually emerge in Cuba, and the way that people really did respond to the revolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
By opposing him very powerfully. Right. And I guess that chapter four is the one in which I really got the sense of Cuba as the mirror of the Haitian Revolution. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this metaphor of the mirror and how you chose the mirror and how that works.
Yeah. 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 That was, you know, titles are always hard, mm-hmm. hard for me, but I did. And I think one of the very first essays I wrote on this project a long time ago, I did use not the title, but the phrase of Cuba becoming a society that was almost a mirror image of Hades in the same moment that Haiti is becoming Haiti, right? That you have the end of slavery and independence.
Mm-hmm.
Cuba then becomes, you know, one of a very important slave society in the region, along with Brazil, obviously, and the U.S. South. And also it becomes the one that remains a colony and not independent. So in those two regards, it becomes the opposite of Haiti in the same moment and as part of some of the same processes. So anyway, that was the idea that in some sense, these two places that are just miles apart, that, you know, on clear days, people say the, you know, some of the mountains in the east are visible from Haiti, that these two places are undergoing kind of mirrored transformations, the entrenchment of slavery in one, the destruction of it in the other. So that was the idea. And also just the fact that, you know, the mirror conveys not just that weird sense of inverse, but also the idea that they're looking at one another. And I do think that Haiti for Cuba always existed as something that it compared itself to, would be compared to, et cetera, et cetera. And then in that specific chapter, chapter four, I think there you have the added factor that you have these the refugees from Saint-Domé who are arriving in Santiago and producing a little Haiti, right? Mm-hmm. This little southern Haiti, this little concentrated zone of coffee production and slavery, in contrast to the society emerging in Haiti at the same time.
Yeah, that part was really interesting, and especially the reinforcement of the point of the possibility of re-enslavement for a lot of the people who had been enslaved in Haiti and then became free, but then the possibility of re-enslavement always lurks. And in the way that Rebecca Scott and Jean Ebrard write about that, but you really make it not just a story of, you know, a few individuals or a few families, but a really a broad process that was affecting almost everybody there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's a theme that was already there even in chapter three, that the Santo Domingo chapter, mm-hmm. right? Because that's when these people who were becoming French citizens could be captured and re-enslaved in Santo Domingo or sent to Cuba, et cetera. So it's a theme that recurs throughout all the chapters. And also the other thing is that we tend to think about it in relation to Santiago and the group of migrants and our refugees, right? But but there's that case that I talk about in late 1802 where the French officials are allegedly capturing rebels and insurgents and bringing them to Havana, not to Santiago, but to Havana to sell them as slaves. So it's not just, you know, when I started this book, every time I tell people what it's about, they say, oh, so you're writing about the refugees in Santiago. And I was like, well, they're in the book, but it's actually, you know, it's not about that. And the impact of Haiti in Cuba was also a very Havana story. It reverberated in Havana differently than in Santiago, but it was a very powerful reverberation there, in part because that was the center of the rise of slavery.
Right.
On the island, yeah.
Yeah, and there was the sort of, I mean, one of the things that happens in the book is that there are all of these tensions between things that do happen and things that don't happen, right? So there's the prohibition of the so-called negros franceses, but then the arrival of all of these people who were rebels and are being sold as slaves, right? And so the kind of contradictions that you kind of uncover and that shape the whole book are really, really central to understanding how complicated that moment was. And one of the points that I really like also about the book is how you make the point often about what a prolonged struggle it really was. And the way it almost, I want to talk about this a little bit later, but the book almost takes us up into, almost into the Cuban Wars of Independence. In fact, someone who I was talking to about this book said, oh, so it's a prequel to her first book, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you imagined it that way or not.
Yeah. Well, I was in Havana last month and somebody said, oh, so you're doing a trilogy. This is the first piece. And Insurgent Cuba was the last piece, and now you're writing the middle piece. And I hadn't thought about that before.
Are you doing a trilogy?
I hadn't thought about it. No, I mean, that's not my plan, though. I might still change. Yeah.
One of the other kind of mirroring effects takes place with foreign policy, right? So mm-hmm. you make the argument that they inspired rebellion, but perhaps not directly. And I'd love to hear you talk more about that, how that dynamic works, but also they didn't overtly support anti-slavery in other places, right?
Right.
As a matter of policy.
Yeah. That we know of. Mm-hmm. There's always that caveat.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I've always, in part, you know, in chapter 5, there's a long discussion of this, conspiracy in Guada in 1806, in which one of the leaders was born in Saint-Domingue, and he claims to have participated in the Haitian Revolution. And so I had an earlier article where I wrote a lot about that piece, and so I became very interested in the question of what does it mean to have someone from Saint-Domingue having claimed to participate in the Haitian Revolution be leading an alleged conspiracy in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, then there's there's debate in the scholarship on the Haitian Revolution and the Haitian state on whether Haiti supported slave rebellion or conspiracy elsewhere. There's a conspiracy in the island of Trinidad that some people claim Haiti had a part in. But again, there's no Haitian state documents that would clarify that question necessarily. That would either confirm or rule out that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So. Anyway, but that's an open question. It's an open question. I think there are some people, some historians, who ruled out the possibility of Haitian involvement, and have insisted that when slaves elsewhere talked about the fact that they were getting Haitian help, whether in the case of Aponte or in the case of Denmark Vesey in the U.S., a decade later, they always think that that's just the enslaved talking and spreading rumors, or it's wishful thinking, or they've been drinking or what have you, and it's just talk, furious mm-hmm. talk, is what one of them said. And I feel like, in some sense, it's too, that may be too narrow a reading of the question, that even if the Haitian state did not send agents to plantations to rise the slaves up in rebellion, the Haitian state was doing other things that could have inspired slaves to act, right? So, mm-hmm. I feel like our measure of what Haitian inspiration and Haitian involvement is maybe should be a little bit broader.
Mm-hmm.
And one example, it's a little bit later, so I don't get to it till the epilogue, is the 1816 Constitution, where the Haitian Republic in the South says that any black or brown or red person who arrives in Haiti will be Haitian and therefore free. That's not promoting rebellion, but that's a foreign policy.
Yeah.
it's a policy of asylum and refuge and recognition, and that people do try to take advantage of, and that the Haitian state protects. So that's a form of projecting an anti-slavery foreign policy that isn't about sending agents to conspire.
Right, but does that policy evolve a little bit? Because when Napoleon sort of shows up on the scene, you talk about the way that Christophe starts capturing slave ships bound for Havana and freeing the captives.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if that policy sort of evolves over time. And you do make the point that the initial policy of not overtly supporting anti-slavery is a practical one,
right,
in terms of the politics of the day. And so it's interesting to see how that evolves.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think there's indications of, there's hints at that policy earlier. There are, for example, even before that, when Dessalines becomes head of state in 1804, almost immediately he initiates a policy where people who have left or who have been taken from Saint-Domingue during the revolution, if they want to come back, they will be received. So that's, you know, and those people could be enslaved. It doesn't explicitly say, right? But in some sense, it's a way of trying to make Haitian freedom available to people who aren't in that moment on Haitian soil, right? So that's an 1805 example. You have examples of Christophe capturing slave ships bound for Havana and bringing the ships to Haitian coast and freeing the captives, right? That's another example. So, and then the 1816, you know, the explicit article, it's Article 44 of the Constitution, that is the highest expression, I think, of that policy.
Mm-hmm. And it's one that sort of, that gets forgotten often in the narratives about the Haitian Revolution not being recognized by other states for
right.
a really long time, but this question of free soil, which you wrote about in your article, seems like it's a really important one.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to think about it in this moment in which Dominicans of Haitian descent are being mm-hmm. nationalized. You think of the Dominican Constitution and Dominican law now, it's like the complete opposite of that. Of that principle established in the Haitian Constitution of 1816.
Yeah, that's an interesting connection.
Actually. Yeah, I mean, one is incredibly open; the other one is everything but.
So. Yeah. So you close with Aponte, and I'm curious to know how you. I want to talk a lot about Aponte because I found this chapter really fascinating, and in some ways very different from the other chapters. But how did you make that decision to close with Aponte?
Well, I thought from the start that I would close. Well, no, I wasn't sure when I started the book where I would close, how far into the 19th century I would go, but I knew that Aponte would be a part of it. So in those first trips, I was looking for material on him and on the movement. So, and I think from knowing the story of Aponte and having heard about the portraits of Christophe and Toussaint and so on that he had in his room, that in his house, that I knew that for him the Haitian Revolution was an inspiration, right? So if one of the questions is what impact does the Haitian Revolution have on Cuba and on Cuban slavery, and a subset of that is, did it inspire or shape processes of slave rebellion or free people of color rebellion or conspiracy? Then Aponte obviously will be a part of the answer to that question. So I knew he and the movement would be in there. I didn't know how they would be in there exactly. And I think I imagined it always as a chapter, but maybe I didn't imagine it as long a chapter. I think, but also the fact that so many, not so many people, but that a group of scholars have been working on Aponte the last, 15 or so years also kind of gave me a lot of more material to work with, more questions to grapple with, more interpretations to bounce off of. So I think it just was very productive in that way. So that chapter, it engages obviously the archival record quite a bit, but also Matt Childs's work and Sibylla Fischer and Stefan Palmier and Jorge Ojeda. So that, in some sense, it's the most historiographical chapter, perhaps, maybe, but it doesn't read overtly that way. But.
No, but it is true that it's the one in which you argue most explicitly with scholarship. And I'm wondering if you can just give us a brief sort of account of where you position yourself in terms of that scholarship.
Yeah. Well, I would say a couple of things. First, just kind of on a so in terms of discipline, I feel like there are historians who've worked on Aponte, and there are kind of cultural scholars who've worked on him, whether Stefan Palmier out of anthropology and Sibylla Fischer out of literature, etc. And I feel like those two camps didn't always kind of talk to each other, except to in the case of Stefan Palmier and Matt Childs, to refute each other a little bit. But generally, they didn't engage each other that deeply, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so but that's not just in terms of like the scholarship and the debates among scholars, but even in how they approach the record. So I think the cultural scholars tended to focus on the trial testimony that dealt with Aponte's missing book. Mm-hmm. And the historians tended to focus on the archival record that focused on the actual rebellion and the conspiracy. And they tended to avoid the book in a central way. I mean, they talk about it, obviously, but not in a really central analytical way. So I felt like what I wanted to do was to bridge those, that I believe that because Aponte showed the book to fellow conspirators, because he had hidden it as if he knew it was something subversive, that I did think that the book had some connection to the anti-slavery movement. And I thought that the book could be, therefore, if I'm interested in the anti-slavery movement, I can't ignore the book, right? So I wanted to kind of restore the book to the historical process and look at both the book and the movement. So my idea was to kind of bridge them a little bit. And I would say also that there's a central question in the historiography, in part raised by Stéphane Pommier, who doubted very forcefully in his important chapter on Aponte. And it's an incredibly smart, important piece of work. But he really casts doubt on whether this had been an anti-slavery, pro-independence movement. He casts doubt on whether Aponte had been really the leader. And I think the more that I got into the record, the more absolutely convinced I was that it was anti-slavery, that he was, if not the leader, then one of two leaders, right? So I felt like in the end, I side more with Franco and Childs on the fact that this is an anti-slavery movement. I'm a little less convinced than they are that it's nationalist in the way they say it's nationalist. But at the same time, I deal with some of the material that Pommier deals with. I really do try to focus on the images or the descriptions of images in the book.
Yeah, it's a fantastic methodological model, I think, for how to deal with a source that you actually didn't see, right? And It's reading through that is really wonderful because there are so many layers, and I guess this is where it becomes clear that you have had a background in English and literary studies or something, because all of those layers come clear in the way that you kind of weave what he said and what the picture might have looked like. And I really enjoyed the way you take on each, not every single one, but the images and sort of do some research into, okay, what was this ship and what was the symbolism of it and how did that, how did you come to that method? I've never really read anything like that before.
Well, you know, it's like you read the descriptions of the images, right? So there's 72 images in total. And so what I did was, I sat with the trial testimony and I read it really carefully, and then I did notes on each image. And then I looked at my notes and I thought, okay, well, what is this? And some of the things I just had no idea what they were. So you start doing research and you start interpreting it the way you would a text, really, because you know the image isn't there, so what you have is essentially a very difficult resistant kind of text. So I just started just researching all, you know, different elements. And then, what I tried to do is to see if when other people were questioned about the book, try to match up those people's descriptions of an image with Aponte's to get a sense of how he might have described the images to other people. So I was trying to kind of get at just approach each image from as many layers as possible. And so, again, it was one of those things where I didn't set out to do that. It just kind of evolved organically. And, you know, and again, that this is where, like, having done all this work came in handy. So I was doing that, the image where there's the ship, of, you know, and there's the San Lorenzo. And you know, he says nothing about the San Lorenzo other than identifying it as the San Lorenzo. And nobody asked him about that when he testified. But, you know, so I was like searching through my notes, and then I came across the fact that some of his fellow conspirators had done service on that ship. So but it wasn't in researching the image that I found that. That was research that I had, like, when I was doing some other aspect of Abonde, right? So in some sense, it is, like, culling this really kind of, I don't know, events or, you know, this substantial, I would say, archival foundation. It's never as substantial as one wants in the end, but the more substantial, the better, I think. It lets you do more.
No, that does, it speaks for casting your net rather broadly and just gathering things that you may or may not know what they mean at the moment, but that seem to fall in place eventually, right?
Yeah.
So one of the conclusions I drew from this book is the extension in space and also time of the Haitian Revolution, right? I mean, Aponte is 1812, which by most accounts, the Haitian Revolution is over by then. But also the, you know, the way that you expand it into Santo Domingo and into Cuba.
Yeah.
And so when the movement to end slavery finally does come in Cuba, you make this point that some of those people, they're all connected, and Haiti is still very much in the very concrete memories of these people, and some of the people lived through those struggles, right?
Right.
The way that it bridges the one and the other, I found really remarkable. I don't know if that was your intention.
No, not really, not at the outset. Again, I think as I mentioned, I didn't know when I was going to end this book. I thought maybe I would go to 1868, and that as I got in the archive, I realized there's just too much. I'll never finish.
Mm-hmm.
Then I thought I would go to 1848 and, you know, in France maybe, or like to go through the Escalera conspiracy rebellion in Cuba in 1843-44. And even that became too much. And then I just had to finish, and I had so much material that I just decided to end in 1812. But I did want the epilogue to look forward and to grasp that the sense of continuing connection between these two places. And so I did it kind of very briefly in the epilogue. I wish I could have done more, but at that point I just couldn't.
But it makes the point, right? And it does really bridge those two, or it did for me in a way that I kind of, you know, it was sort of implicit, kind of there, but really did it in a very concrete fashion. So
yeah, and also, I mean, I remember like thinking back to insurgent Cuba, that in some sense that specter of Haiti was so used by the Spanish state and mm-hmm. and some of the pro-Spanish. And the anti-independence elite in Cuba, that it just became this like mantra. It'll be another Haiti. It'll be African, or it'll be Cuban. It'll be Haiti, right? And it was this very kind of negative, mm-hmm. Repressive invocation of Haiti. But even doing insurgent Cuba, you would occasionally get glimpses of other kinds of invocations, right? So there was the fact that somebody flew a Haitian flag, or that someone was singing in the countryside verses about Haitian independence, or, you know, I think it was Rafael Segre, who I write about in the first book, a black journalist, who invokes a positive image of Haiti in one instance. So, or maybe even in more than one, I can't remember. But so I do think that even in that later period, there are these different invocations of Haiti, but in either case, Haiti it looms incredibly large for the history of Cuba in the 19th and into the 20th century.
Yeah. So we've taken up a lot of your time, and I'm wondering if you have any final thoughts, anything I didn't touch on that you wanted to make sure to be included.
No, I think we covered just about everything, I think.
Great. So would you like to tell us what you're working on now or in the future?
Well, I haven't quite decided. So I may go on to do more work on Aponte. I'm thinking of doing a little book on him, but I haven't quite decided. I'm doing a couple of archive trips this summer. I went to Cuba in May. I'm going to Spain in July. Just looking for things that I hope will help me decide how much more I have to say about him and his movement and his book than I say here. So that's a possibility, but I haven't quite decided.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look forward to whatever emerges from that.
Yeah. Or I might do something really general. I might just do a history of Cuba. Maybe, I don't know. I haven't decided.
Mm-hmm.
If you have any ideas, tell me.
No, I've got enough to deal with on my own.
Right.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Sure. Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for doing this and for doing all the other ones you do. All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman, and I hope you can join me next time.